Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Does everybody have a copy of the tables, the charts? Okay, we are continuing now with the explanation of the Satipatthana Sutta, Sutta number 10. In the middle-length discourses. And we're in the section on Dhammanupassana. This I would now call contemplation of phenomena. And last time, this was 2 weeks ago, I explained what I would call the general pattern that runs, that underlies the section on Dhammanupassana. The structure, but you might consider the progressive structure of this particular series of meditative exercises. And now we can explore each of the sections in greater detail. And the first section is the section on the five mental hindrances, the pancha nivarana. Okay, and so the text, we're now on page 151 in paragraph 36 of the text. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating, here I'll use the newer translation, contemplating phenomena as phenomena. Here, a bhikkhu abides contemplating phenomena as phenomena. Phenomena in place of mind objects, in terms of the five hindrances. Okay, so now the new question comes. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating phenomena as phenomena in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, or when there is sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in him, that is, when there is no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. Then the same pattern is repeated with each of the other four hindrances, when there is ill will in him, when there is sloth and torpor, now I would call this dullness and drowsiness in him, when when there is restlessness and remorse in him, when there is doubt in him, a bhikkhu understands there is doubt in me, or when there is no doubt in him, he understands there is no doubt in me. And he understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen doubt, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen doubt, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned doubt. Okay, so in the contemplation of phenomena or mind objects, the Buddha first takes those particular mental phenomena that constitute the main obstacles to meditative progress. And these are the many phenomena, many unwholesome mental states. The Buddha has set up one particular set or scheme, which he calls the five hindrances, five obstacles. And here he makes these the objects of contemplation first, because these are the qualities or states that have to be cleared away or overcome in order to enter upon further progress both in developing concentration or samadhi and developing panya, prajna, wisdom. And now what is particularly interesting and important is that usually we think that these unwholesome mental states are merely obstacles to meditative progress. And when they come up in the course of meditation, we feel that they are being simply impediments, that they're frustrating us, blocking our progress. And then we think, sometimes we get discouraged and think we don't have sufficient accumulations of merit from past lives for doing meditation. We don't have sufficient wholesome roots for doing meditation. And so we think maybe we have to give up meditation in this life and just do good deeds in order to get merit so that we can practice in a future life. But in fact, except for those who have really practiced very diligently over many lives, we all have these problems with mental impediments, mental hindrances. What the Buddha has done is to set up a system of meditation that can use these obstructive mental states and make them objects of contemplation that can actually become part of the soil of understanding, the soil for the development of insight, understanding, or wisdom. This is somewhat like taking, like compare this, when we finish eating meals, we have the leftover garbage, you know, eggshells, orange rinds, leftover bits of food that we don't want to eat. Usually we just throw it into the garbage can and throw it away. But we could take this leftover bits of food, cores of fruit, bits of bread and so on, and we make a compost heap, and then we can use it as soil for the garden, and it will help the growth of the flowers and bushes and plants, trees that we're trying to grow. And so these unwholesome qualities of mind, if they're handled skillfully, then they can become, I don't want to try to shed them in a positive light to valorize them, but they can become, in a way, helpers on the road to liberation. And instead of fighting against them, which if we try to fight against them, in a way that strengthens them. And once one just tries to fight against them with a very firm, ferocious, and aggressive stance, then that gives them more strength and gives them more prominence in our minds. But the way to weaken them, to remove their power, is to turn them into objects of observation, to contemplation. And so we have in this contemplation of the five hindrances, we can actually divide it into four main sections. The first section is concerned simply with noting presence or absence. I'll come to the other three sections later. Okay, so in this first section, we're concerned simply to note the presence or absence of one of the five hindrances. And so when a hindrance arises in the mind, and as the mind becomes trained in meditation, when the faculty of attention becomes more and more strongly developed, then one becomes aware of the arising of the hindrances at subtler levels. And sometimes the development of stronger concentration will actually stir up levels of the hindrances that have been lying dormant in the mind, unrecognized, unactivated for a long time. So somebody who might be normally quite placid in day-to-day life, when they start doing meditation, sometimes strong irritation, thoughts of anger, ill will start bubbling into the mind. Other people who might seem quite contented, self-possessed, suddenly strong sensual fantasies start coming up. Other people who are very active and energetic in everyday life, when they start sitting in meditation, dullness and drowsiness come in. Other people who seem very tranquil and calm in everyday life, suddenly restless thoughts come bubbling into the mind. Then also, just about everybody faces this problem with doubts start coming into the mind. Even sometimes advanced meditators who have been practicing for many years, suddenly some doubts start coming up and become major obstacles. Okay, so when one of these hindrances comes up into the mind, one way to deal with it is simply to note it and to turn it into an object of observation. So instead of letting it, when one is not mindful of the hindrance, it is standing in the back of the mind, we might say, propelling the mind from behind. It's like an engine of the car. Well, the engine of the car is in the front of the car. It's like the motorboat has the engine in the back. So it's like the motor of the motorboat, which is in the back and is propelling it forward. And so when we're not mindful of this particular hindrance, then it's in the background of the mind, in the back of the mind, pushing it forward. But then when we turn the hindrance into an object of observation and just note the presence of this particular hindrance, first simply becoming aware that this hindrance has arisen, then the first procedure is just to note the presence of the hindrance, then try to let it go and turn the mind back to the primary object of meditation. For example, if one has made mindfulness of breathing the primary object, then one will turn the attention back to the breath. If one is observing rising and falling, one turns the attention back to rising and falling. If one is observing sensations in the body, then one turns the attention back to the sensations. But if this hindrance keeps on repeatedly coming back into the mind so that one can no longer focus upon the primary object, then one just lets the primary object go and just makes that hindrance an object of observation and looks at the hindrance, observes it, watches the way this hindrance affects the feeling in the mind, the way it affects the other mental components, observe the way it, the impact it has on the body. And so when it's turning this whole process of experience into an object of observation, one will see how the hindrance, this particular state, whether sensual desire, ill will, how it arises, and then it subsides. Sometimes it arises, subsides. Sometimes it comes in spurts of thoughts very quickly. Other times it becomes very slow. So one starts noting change, modifications in the way this hindrance runs through the mind. These are observations of the impermanent nature of that particular state. Then when the hindrance, there'll come a time when one is observing it, that the hindrance falls away suddenly, and again the mind becomes clear and bright. Then one becomes aware, one makes the note that the hindrance has vanished, has stopped. One now notes that the hindrance has stopped, is no longer present in me. In that case, one is understanding there is no sensual desire in me, or there is no ill will in me. Whichever hindrance has been present, has been disturbing the mind, when it is gone and remains gone for some time, then one becomes aware that it is gone. Okay, so the first stage of understanding regarding the five hindrances is noting simply the presence of the hindrance. And then when the hindrance has vanished, gone away, noting the absence of that hindrance. Then we come to the second level of understanding. The second level of the four. This is, he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen hindrance, whether it's sensual desire or so on. I might as well just go through the four levels and then we'll come to treat them in detail. Okay, so the second level of understanding is understanding how there comes to be the arising of the hindrance while it has not yet arisen. The third level of understanding is understanding how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen hindrance. And the fourth level is understanding how there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned hindrance. That is how that hindrance, when it's abandoned, is cut off so that it can no longer arise in the future. Okay, now we could turn to the chart that I made up, which gives detailed treatment to these levels of understanding based upon other suttas and also upon the commentary to the Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, for the hindrance of sensual desire, we have the question how the unarisen sensual desire arises. And a number of suttas say that the primary condition for the arising of an unarisen sensual desire is careless attention or unwise attention. That's ayoniso manasikara, careless attention to a sensually attractive object. And so there are objects, visible forms, beautiful sounds, pleasant scents, delicious tastes. Soft and delightful tactile sensations. And the mind has, first, a lot of accumulated memories of these experiences, and also one comes across repeated contacts with them in the course of day-to-day life. And so either memories come up that are stored deep in the unconscious, they come up in the form of mental images, recollections, memories, or else there come encounters with these objects in the course of day-to-day life. And if one attends to them carelessly, then one focuses upon, fixes upon the attractive appearance of the object. This is called the subha-nimitta, the beautiful or attractive appearance. And that becomes the trigger that instigates or initiates the arising of sensual desire. Okay, then one comes to understand, or one understands how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire. Okay, the sutta, this is the main source from the Samyutta Nikaya, gives as the primary antidote for overcoming arisen sensual desire is careful attention to an unattractive object. This is also a very effective antidote if it's done as a regular meditation. It's an effective antidote that will prevent the arising of unarisen sensual desire if one does this regularly. And what is meant here by the attention to the unattractive object is primarily this meditation on the 32 parts of the body. We have this earlier in the Satipatthana Sutta in section number 10. And so when one does, and I would suggest you try it for short periods, not to do it too long a time, but try it just to go through these 32 parts up and down, and it's quite beneficial. If one goes through the parts of the body from the hairs of the head, hairs of the body, nails, teeth, skin, all the ways down to through the different solid parts of the body to the fluid parts, blood, sweat, fat, down to synovial, this fluid of the joints, tears, skin grease, spittle, snot, fluid of the joints, urine, then up again from urine to the hairs of the head. If it's too difficult to do 32 parts, if one just takes 4 parts, skin, flesh, bones, and blood. It just reflects on them that this body is made up of these parts. Then that will set in motion in the mind a counteractive force to the attractive force of sensually enticing objects. Then when one builds up a certain momentum through the repeated practice of this meditation, then when sensual desire arises, then one just turns the mind to this consideration of the unattractive nature of the body. when one is doing the Satipatthana meditation, I would say the first approach to take to dealing with, sensual desire, when it arises, not to use the reflection on the unattractive object immediately, but just to make the note, the observation, sensual desire has arisen, and try to bring the mind back to the primary object. If sensual desire insists on remaining, then try to observe the sensual desire, make it an object in the mind. If that is not effective, then use the attention to the unattractive object. And then if one sees that one has a persisting problem with sensual desire, in order to weaken it gradually, one can devote time to this meditation on the unattractive nature of the body. The commentaries mention some other methods that are important in order to prevent the arising of unarisen sensual desire and to help to overcome, to abandon arisen sensual desire. One is this is advice given especially for monastics. One is to guard the sense faculties, because it's when one allows the senses to roam about freely amongst their objects that they become naturally, the senses will go out to attractive objects and they'll pick up and fasten upon the signs, the attractive appearances of things. And so the Buddha again and again advises to the monastics the practice of restraint of the sense faculties, indriya sangvara, that one keeps the senses under control so that they don't attach to pleasant objects of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and that they don't become repelled by unpleasant objects. Then he also recommends moderation in food, since when one just carelessly overeats, then the overeating will give a kind of sluggishness to the mind, and then the mind will become lax, it'll lose the sense of diligence, heedfulness, and will become more prone to wander amongst sensually thoughts of sensual desire. And then a constant factor in helping to overcome all of the hindrances is to cultivate good friends, that is, noble spiritual friends, and engage in suitable conversation, that is, conversation that is helpful to overcoming each of the hindrances. Then in some of the suttas, similes are given which illustrate the effect of these hindrances on the mind. We have two sets of similes. One of them compares each of the five similes to the effect of some extraneous element upon a body of water. The idea here is the reason why somebody cannot see their reflection accurately in a body of water. In one case, this body of water, it might be water in a cup or a bowl, is mixed with different colored paints and dyes. And so when you have different colored paints and dyes in the water, you look at your face comes the same color as that, the dyes and paints. So if you have a mixture of red, blue, yellow paint, then you look at your face, and your face is red, blue, yellow, green. Not the way it really is. Then another set of similes compares the five hindrances to different types of, call these calamities or undesirable conditions. And sensual desire is compared to being in debt. It's the sense of bondage, like somebody who is in the grip of sensual desire is no longer his own master, but wherever he goes, he always has the creditor sort of breathing down his back, seeking after him, pay back my debt, pay back my debt. He can never go any place without being always afraid, always under at the beck and call of the creditor. He's not able to do anything that he wants, but he's under the control of the creditor. And so when one is in the grip of sensual desire, one doesn't have the freedom to do what one wants, for one is always in bondage to one's own desires. Okay, and then the fourth level of understanding is how there comes to be the future non-arising of the sensual desire that has been temporarily abandoned. And the commentary explains that this means at what stage is sensual desire completely eradicated so that it can never arise again in the future. And the commentary to the Satipatthana says that this occurs through the path of arahantship. Now this seems to maybe to raise the question, if some people know the Dhamma quite well, they will think sensual desire, it's said that sensual desire is abandoned completely at the stage of non-returner. So why does the commentary say that it's eliminated at the stage of arhatship? Well, this is what the commentary says, that we should understand sensual desire here as having a wider application, a wider meaning simply than the desire through the five senses. But sensual desire here can mean any kind of craving. And so all craving is eliminated only at the stage of arhatship. And therefore, it's at the stage of arhatship that the hindrance of sensual desire is completely eradicated. That's the commentarial way of explanation. But if we stay very strictly to the sutta way of explanation, then we would say that sensual desire, desire through the five senses, is eliminated really at the stage of non-returner. Is there any question about this?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
Because you have explained the sensual desire has wider and narrower meaning.
Yeah.
And you primary condition, primary principle is in the narrower condition.
Yeah.
And this classification is according to the Sutta.
This classification of the primary condition, primary antidote, this is according to the sutta. But also the commentary accepts this too, because the commentary explains, when it's commenting on the Satipatthana Sutta, it says, what is the primary condition for the arising of sensual desire? Then it will quote the sutta and say the primary condition is careless attention to an attractive object. And what is the primary way of eliminating the sensual desire? It is careful attention to an unattractive object, and then meditation, learning the meditation. It's learning and practicing the meditation on the unattractive object. So it seems the commentary really treats sensual desire pretty much in the narrow sense as desire for the sensually attractive sense objects, objects of the five senses, all the ways up to, only up to that question, where is sensual desire? How is it completely eradicated? when it comes to that question, it seems to broaden the range of sensual desire to include every type of craving. And then it says, sensual desire is eradicated only at the stage of, only by the path of arhatship. It's a little bit inconsistent.
My sensual desire is desire of five senses.
Why is sensual desire desire for the five sense objects? Because sensual desire, the Pali name for it is kama chanda. Okay, that means kama chanda. It would be, we have an expression, kama guna. Kama guna means the objects, the sensual objects, sense objects. And so the desire for kama guna, for the sense objects, is kama chanda, sensual desire. It doesn't actually mean object. It's one of those words with many meanings. It has a sense of quality, you could say of quality, sensual qualities, you might say.
Nature, function.
Even nature, you could say, not so much function, nature is okay. Any further questions? Yes, Peter?
So, the first step, the noting presence and absence. So we note the absence in relation to the fact that it had arisen and now it's gone. We wouldn't just note the absence.
This is my understanding. Okay, the question... Okay, I'm going to repeat the question so that it comes into the recorders. The question is, do you note the absence only in relation to the presence, only as the opposite of the presence? I would say so. It's not that one sits down, say, and just that day one hasn't had any doubts, and for a long time one has had doubts so that one thinks, okay, there's no doubt in me now. Or one has not been restless today, one hasn't been restless for the last few days. One doesn't have any need to make a particular point of noting there's no restlessness and worry in me now. But it's only when that hindrance has been previously present and been creating disturbance in the mind, now it's gone, then one notes its absence. Then its absence stands forth. You might say the absence becomes a presence in a sense, the presence of the non-existence of the hindrance. Okay, let me go on to the next hindrance, the hindrance of ill will. Okay, according to this sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, the primary condition for the arising of ill will is careless attention to a repugnant object. And ill will, this would be primarily, the word ill will, vyapada, generally implies ill will towards persons. So there can be ill will towards persons and ill will towards inanimate objects. But particularly ill will tends to arise towards persons. And so when people sometimes act rudely towards us, speak in ways that are unpleasant to us, do things that are disagreeable to us, then the mind fastens upon these repugnant aspects of their behavior, their manners, their speech, and by dwelling upon these features, there arises ill will, displeasure, aversion. And so when ill will arises initially, again, I would say that the primary way to handle it is simply to become aware there is ill will in me. If it is persisting for some time, one goes on simply turning the ill will into an object, watches, observes the way it affects the mind, not fighting against it, but just watching it. And by putting it out in front, again, it starts to lose its power until it becomes just almost a powerless actor, which soon gets bored playing this futile role, and then it withdraws from the stage. But if the ill will becomes something which persists and which arises regularly, particularly when the ill will arises regularly, then that's an indicator that the ill will is not arising from the external world, but it's arising from our own character. And it's just other people, the things they do, the things they say, those are just, call it trigger points for this inherent disposition in our character towards ill will. Then one has to weaken that tendency, weaken and try to overcome it by using a deliberate strategy. And so that primary antidote, that primary strategy to overcome ill will is the development of or practice of the meditation on loving kindness, the metta bhavana, the practice of loving kindness, jibbe. And so one, usually if there's a particular person who is causing one ill will, one doesn't begin with that person, but one begins in the systematic way with oneself, developing goodwill towards oneself, wishing that one might be well, happy, free from harm and suffering. Then one takes friendly people, people who are well disposed towards oneself, respected teachers, parents, friends, develops loving kindness towards them. Then neutral or indifferent people, develops loving kindness to them. Then after the mind develops strength of loving kindness towards oneself, towards friendly people, towards neutral people, then one can extend it towards the hostile people. And if one sees that this aversion or ill will is a repeated trait in one's character, then one should use a little bit of the loving kindness meditation every day as an antidote to that. It's a way of training the mind, redirecting the mind. Then when ill wills, if it arises towards inanimate objects or towards external conditions, not towards a person, then we don't describe any kind of malevolent intent to external conditions. Unless we're completely paranoid, then we do. But normally we don't. Then the way to overcome this ill will towards external conditions, inanimate objects that might be displeasing us, is to do the meditation on the elements. We just consider, even just doing reflection on the elements, we consider that these disturbing conditions are just combinations of the four great elements arisen through dependent origination, through the law of conditionality. There are conditions which bring them into existence. They're sustained by conditions. When the conditions change, they'll vanish. If one does reflection in this way, then that ill will subside. Okay, then the commentary mentions some other remedies for reducing ill will. Guarding the sense faculties. That is because the sense faculties become attached to or go out to note not only things that are sensually attractive, but also if you just observe your mind, sometimes when there are things that are particularly annoying or irritating, you'll see how the senses go out to observe those things that are annoying. Like in my experience, years ago, I always used to have disturbance with dogs barking when I sit down to meditate. This was particularly in Sri Lanka, because every village has dogs. And during the day, one doesn't notice the dogs barking or not, but it's just in the evening, one sits down to meditate. And one hardly crosses one's legs and puts the hands on the lap, when one is starting to listen, are they barking? Are they barking yet? And so when it's not even before the mind goes to the breath, it's not like doing the mindfulness of breathing, but it's the mindfulness of barking meditation. So one sits there, and then maybe there's 10 seconds that no barking sound. Okay, they're not barking tonight. Then one thinks, what a relief, no barking tonight. I could just go to my breath. In, out, in, woof, out, in, woof, woof, woof. There they go. Then I've start listening, what village are they coming from? Tomorrow morning I'm going to go to that village and tell the people they have to tell their dogs to stop barking. So then I would go out of my little cottage, this sort of clearing in front. I'd be listening. Is the barking coming from this direction, that direction? And it seems like once you go out to start listening, what direction is the barking coming from? I don't know if it's like, I don't think it's like this in America, but in South Asia, Southeast Asia, once one dog starts barking, it's sort of like, one dog barking will set off the dogs barking in village B. When the dogs in village B start barking, the dogs in village C will start barking, until it turns into a whole ocean of dogs barking and barking and barking, till, okay, through the whole meditation period, then, okay, my 45 minutes or hour is up. Uncross the legs, and you know what happens? All the barking stops. Even when I go out on the veranda porch to listen, where is the barking coming from? Very often, all the barking stops. Even though the dogs are a quarter of a mile away, they don't have any idea that I'm coming out. But this is the way the senses are always going out, until finally I learned just not to pay any attention to the barking. I think Achan Cha said, it's not the sound that is disturbing your mind. It's your mind that is disturbing the sound. Okay, so if one guards the senses, which doesn't mean that you can eliminate the sound, but you just don't grasp the sound. Then the sound will go on, it will continue, but it won't disturb the mind. Then also they recommend moderation in food. I'm wondering if I made a mistake there, because I don't see that as a particular obstacle to a particular condition for ill will. Okay, but good friends and suitable conversation, that is, those are also helpful for overcoming ill will. If one is disposed to ill will, if one has good friends, they will help one, give one advice. They'll do conversation, one gets instruction on how to overcome ill will. Then the similes, the simile about water compares ill will to boiling water. Because when the mind is angry, upset, it's just like bubbles are coming repeatedly through the water. And so if you try to look at your reflection in the water when it's bubbling with ill will, then you're not able to see the reflection. And also the other set of similes compare ill will to having a severe illness. Because when a person has a severe illness, this is the way the simile is developed, that whatever they give this whatever the friends give the ill person, nothing agrees with him. Whatever they give him to eat, he eats, tries to eat any food, but no appetite. They give him delicious drinks, but whatever he sips on, none of it appeals to his taste. And so when one has ill will, then everything becomes disagreeable to one. If you go to look at, people take you to see beautiful scenery, you look at it, nothing is pleasant. They play beautiful music for you and it just sounds like noise. So nothing is agreeable when one has ill will in the mind. Okay, and then the stage where ill will is eliminated completely, how it's eradicated at the stage of the path of the non-returner. That is how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned ill will. Okay, the next hindrance is actually, it's a combination of two hindrances which are a little bit different, dullness and drowsiness, but they're joined together because they both have the similar characteristic of, you call it, making the mind heavy, weighing the mind down, okay, of making the mind stiff and unwieldy. Okay, tina, what's called tina, is a dullness or rigidity of the mind. And midda is drowsiness. Not the ordinary, it's not natural sleepiness that comes when one's proper bedtime arrives. But it's a drowsiness that might come on even if one is sitting to meditate in the middle of the day, early evening, even in the morning. But just the mind suddenly, even though a few minutes ago it was bright and alert, but suddenly it just becomes dull, then it gets drowsy, sleepy, and starts dropping off, nodding off. And so the condition for this, according to the sutta, is careless attention to discontent. Sometimes when one becomes discontented, bored, dissatisfied, instead of giving rise to ill will, the mind just stiffens and blocks itself off from trying to deal in a skillful way with the cause of ill will and dissatisfaction, and then it just becomes dull and sleepy. Then sometimes just passing states of lethargy arise, and if one attends to them carelessly instead of dealing with them skillfully, then that states of lethargy will turn into dullness and drowsiness. Then naturally a kind of drowsiness arises after meals. In fact, this is recognized in the commentaries. It says sometimes after meals one should take a rest for meditators. It doesn't say one should start vigorously trying to meditate right after meals, but one should take a short rest so that until that natural drowsiness falls off by itself. But that will take place sometimes after 20 minutes, 30 minutes. But sometimes if one overeats, eats too heavily, then that torpor will persist and turn into strong drowsiness. That's why one has to avoid, one has to practice moderation in eating. And then a kind of sluggishness of mind. When the mind becomes sluggish, then that could turn into dullness and drowsiness. Okay, then the primary antidote to dullness and drowsiness is careful attention to, there are three, we're called three elements of energy. One is called the arousing of effort, arambha dhatu. This is the stage where one is simply arousing or instigating energy. Then the middle stage is the stage where one is persisting in one's effort. And then the third stage is, I call it the stage of vigorous effort, where that effort has picked up strength and momentum, is continuing undaunted, uninterrupted. Okay, so when dullness and drowsiness tend to settle upon the mind, then one has to arouse one's energy. After arousing the energy, one has to persist, and one has to make the energy become very strong and vigorous. Some other remedies recommended in the commentaries. One is moderation in food, because if one takes excess food, then the food becomes heavy in the stomach. It brings the blood down to the stomach, and the mind becomes sleepy, dull, and drowsy. Another way to overcome dullness and drowsiness is to change the postures, particularly if one has been doing the sitting meditation and dullness and drowsiness settle upon the mind. Then it is recommended that one leaves aside the sitting meditation and one does a kind of rapid walking meditation, not the very slow walking meditation, but either rapidly or at a moderate pace, and that will help to dispel that drowsiness. Another recommendation is to leave aside other meditation objects and use what is called the perception of light as one's meditation. The perception of light means that one takes mental impression of a light. Particularly, they recommend the sunlight, the image of the sun, or it could be the disk of the moon, some bright light, and one tries to see it in one's mind, with one's mind's eye, so that one could see the light as clearly with one's eyes shut, or at night as one would if one were looking at the sun or the full moon with one's eyes open. Then that light of the visual image will flood into the mind. When the light floods into the mind, then it dispels that heaviness and dullness of the mind. Then going out into the open air, if one has been staying in the indoors, going out into the open, especially if there's like a cool breeze blowing, that will help to refreshen the body. And when the body is refreshened by the open air, by the cool breeze, then the mind will also become more activated and lively. And then good friends and suitable conversation. Then the similes given in the commentaries, the similes given in the suttas for dullness and drowsiness, for the water simile, they give the simile of a body of water, or even water in a bowl, which has been overgrown by algae and water plants like moss. When you have the water covered with algae, moss, then when you look at into the water, you can see your reflection very clearly because of all of the plants growing there. And then the similes that come from the other set of similes, dullness and drowsiness is like imprisonment. When you're imprisoned, you're in a very narrow space, in a cell, but with your hands and feet tied up in bonds, can't move at all, can't move about freely. And so when the mind is overwhelmed by dullness and drowsiness, it's just cramped in and doesn't want, it's not able to go anywhere, not able to do anything very effectively. It's a very heavy, obstructive state. Okay, next we come to restlessness and remorse. This is another case of two hindrances, two different mental afflictions, defilements, that have been joined together into a compound because they are similar. They're actually two distinct states, but they're both similar in that they cause disturbance to the mind. Uneasiness of mind. Udaccha is restlessness or agitation. Kukucha is the feeling after one has done something wrong of remorse or regret. Okay, the primary condition, according to the sutta, is careless attention to the unsettled mind. I have to say this is a little puzzling to me, since here the mind is already unsettled. So what is the condition that's caused the mind to become unsettled? And there are many things that can cause the mind to become unsettled. Maybe it's because the causes for the mind to become unsettled or disturbed are so many that it was impossible for the sutta to mention them. But whatever the cause might be, if one attends carelessly to the unsettled mind and doesn't deal with it skillfully, then the unsettled mind will just, the unsettledness of mind will just grow and become more and more obstructive till it becomes full-fledged restlessness and remorse. And so the antidote is giving careful attention to peace of mind. And what this really means is giving careful attention to a meditation subject that helps the mind settle down and become peaceful. Particularly, the commentaries recommend mindfulness of breathing. But one could take any meditation subject that brings peace to one's own mind. It could be the recollection of the Buddha, qualities of the Buddha, or just meditation on empty space, open space, or just even a meditation on a beautiful scene that makes the mind become very serene, for example, like a country scene, spacious mountains and rivers, something that helps the mind settle down and become calm. Okay, then, other remedies recommended by the commentaries, they recommend much learning, a lot of knowledge of the Dhamma. That is because when one learns the Dhamma well, then one knows what are the things one should do, one shouldn't do, and so one avoids remorse. That's actually more appropriate for avoiding remorse than restlessness. Asking questions also helps one to settle remorse. Skill in the Vinaya, the discipline, also it's effective in overcoming remorse. Meeting elder monks helps one to overcome remorse because then one learns from them, one can ask them questions. Similarly with good friends, suitable conversation. The similes, the simile of water for restlessness and worry, it's water which has been stirred by a wind into little wavelets so that one can see one's reflection. And the other set of similes, restlessness and remorse, is like slavery. Then how they're eradicated, the stage of eradication. Here there's a distinction. This is according to the commentaries. Restlessness is one of the higher fetters that's eliminated only at the path of arhatship, only by the path of arhatship. Whereas remorse is something which is connected with the hindrance of ill will. It's a feeling of displeasure due to things that one has done or left undone. And so it's eliminated by the path of the non-returner. Okay, then finally we come to the hindrance of doubt. Okay, the primary condition for doubt is careless attention to things that are a basis for doubt. Like, often we have doubtful points. I have to make a distinction between two types of doubt in Buddhism. One is the type of doubt where you have a point of the Dhamma that you don't understand and you want clarification. This is a good type of doubt where you want to get your doubts cleared up, and so a question comes into the mind, you want to have it settled. So this is the kind of doubt that's encouraged. But sometimes there are doubts that come up which are just obstructive questions. It's a kind of closely related to restlessness of mind. One is wondering, is it so or is it not so? Can one really place, especially it's doubt regarding the Buddha as an enlightened one. the doubt whether the Dhamma, the teaching, is true or not. The doubt whether there is truly an Aryan Sangha, a community of enlightened people. Doubt about the path, whether the path will really lead to enlightenment and liberation. Okay, so things, these questions arise in the mind which are a basis for doubt. And if one just thinks when the questions arise, okay, when I meet somebody who knows, I will ask these questions, then one is dealing with the doubt skillfully. But if one doesn't deal with the doubt in this way, but one just continually wavers back and forth, is it this way, is it that way, and just struggles and wrestles with these questions and doubts, then the doubt becomes an obstacle to progress. In that way, this careless attention to things that are a basis for doubt is a primary condition for doubt. And according to the sutta, the primary antidote is careful attention to contrasting mental qualities. So here, the doubt, the primary example of doubt that's given is doubt about what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what is skillful, what is unskillful, what is beneficial, what is harmful. So if one attends carefully to these different mental qualities, then one will come to understand that, for example, greed, hatred, delusion are unwholesome, unskillful, harmful mental states. Generosity, loving kindness, wisdom are wholesome, beneficial, skillful mental states. Then the other contributing factors to overcome doubt, very similar to overcoming restlessness and remorse, except the one difference is in number 4, resolve or resolution, that is making a firm decision not to be distracted by these doubts, not to be swept away by the doubts, but making a resolution to continue along the path despite the doubts that arise. So remaining, you could say, firm in one's determination. Oh, and the similes, I see I left out one simile, the simile of the water. If I remember correctly, it's the simile is that of water which has become cloudy. Cloudy water. Yeah, cloudy. Yeah, the water has become cloudy, dark inside the water, so that you can't see your reflection in the water. And then the other simile is traveling across a desert, because when one is in doubt, it's like being in a barren desert. But a better simile, also that occurs in the sutta, is like being at a crossroads. Or rather, it's a two-forked road, a forked road, not knowing which path to take, and nobody is around to ask, no road signs. So you don't know whether to take the left fork, the left branch, or the right branch of the road. Then how is doubt eradicated so that it doesn't arise anymore in the future? It's eradicated by the path of stream entry. When one attains stream entry, then doubt about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and about the path, these are eliminated completely. There can still be questions about practice, how does one practice, how does one apply the practice to oneself, but these disturbing, obstructive doubts are eliminated completely. Okay, so this takes care of the five hindrances. If there are any questions, then please go ahead and ask. No questions? Okay, Peter.
So I guess the question I asked 2 weeks ago was, how does the five hindrances stand in relation to this meditation? And I guess this shows they haven't been suppressed. The shamatha meditation, you have to get the hindrances.
Not necessarily. Yeah. Of course, it could be that meditators who are practicing the Satipatthana can have overcome the five hindrances. But this section is included to show how to deal with the five hindrances in cases when they're not suppressed, and not suppressed and not overcome. But even when they're suppressed, then one still has to understand how they arise, how they're abandoned, and how they're eliminated.
Well, then that becomes just a purely mental exercise, right?
When it's not seeing in one's own experience how they're overcome. Yeah. But from previous practice, one will know from experience how they've been overcome. Because one has already succeeded in overcoming them.
I couldn't find it in my notes, but did you say that these four sections, the four foundations, are practiced in order?
The four foundations of mindfulness? No, I would have said that they're not necessarily practiced in order. What I said would be that one can use any of the four foundations of mindfulness as a primary basis, but generally within most systems of meditation, a contemplation in the body, one of the body contemplations, is taken as primary, because the body is the grossest object, easiest to observe. And then one will use one might choose one of the foundations of mindfulness as a primary object. Let's say one takes the body as a primary object. But even though one is using the body as a primary object, but that is serving as, we call it, a framework within which the other contemplations will be included. So a bodily object like mindfulness of breathing also will extend out to include contemplation of feeling, contemplation of mind, contemplation of mind objects. In fact, when we come to the Anapanasati Sutta, we'll see how that is done. And if one is doing, say, contemplation of feeling, say within the system of Goenka, observing sensations in the body, then, okay, that system begins with mindfulness of breathing, which is a body contemplation, then moves into contemplation of bodily feelings, bodily sensations. It doesn't give much attention to contemplation of mind, contemplation of mind objects. But they're sort of included implicitly. Since one will naturally become aware of one's state of mind in the course of contemplation, and one will encounter things like the five hindrances, the seven factors of enlightenment.
So, when you talk about access concentration, you would say that that's not something that's necessary for obviously helpful.
What I would say is that one can begin satipatthana without access concentration, but through the practice of satipatthana, it can lead to access concentration, particularly through one of the meditation subjects, which involves a certain degree of mental stabilization, like mindfulness of breathing or the contemplation of the parts of the body, the contemplation of feelings, states of mind. Those contemplations don't involve enough fixing of the mind on one object to be able to lead to access concentration. But they lead to, I would call this a kind of samadhi. I call this vipassana samadhi. It's a concentration in which the mind is stabilized, steady, unwavering, but in which the mind, the object of the mind, is constantly changing. Because the mind is constantly changing, the mind is not able to remain fixed upon the single object long enough to enter into access concentration. But the mind, because it's fixed and steady in its observation of the object, it's a sufficient degree of concentration for insight knowledge to arise. Okay, I think we're running over time, so we'll stop now and share the merits. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.